You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, be sure to visit exo-terra.com, check out your local dealer, and follow at ExoTerra on all social media platforms. This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by Grey Ghost Creations. Specializing in unique wildlife art for lovers of reptiles, amphibians, and arachnids, Grey Ghost Creations offers a wide variety of art prints, stickers, pins, necklaces, and more. To find more unique original art, be sure to visit Grey Ghost Creations on Etsy at www.greyghostcreations.etsy.com. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me once again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandro Bates, your host. And this week, I have a very long-awaited topic and a long-awaited guest. I have Richard Pierce. And Richard is the director of Bushido Adventure Travel Limited, and he is also the CEO of Sustainable Dyson, which is an organization that works with Japanese giant salamanders, a holy grail species for me and many of you, I'm sure, if you will. And it's the first time I've ever had a guest on from Japan, so it's a first for the show. I'm really excited. I'm really looking forward to our interview. It's going to be a lot of fun. I have a lot of interesting questions. Richard has a lot of interesting work that we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, of course, the usual stuff. Thank you to everybody for the nice 5-star reviews on their podcast players, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. And a big shout out to our new $5 a month patron, Drew Martinez. Drew, my man, thank you so much for the patronage. I really appreciate it. It goes a long way. And if you guys want to support the show, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. It helps me defer some of the costs of hosting the show. And follow the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to everything. It'll take you to the Patreon page. $5 a month tier will get you a shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And it'll take you to the merch store, In-Situ Ecosystems discounts, and of course, all the sponsors for this week's episode as well. So be sure and check out the sponsors. So all that stuff out of the way. Richard, I want to thank you for coming on and talk to me. It's been a real long time goal of me to be able to discuss giant salamanders and to have a guest on from Japan. And I'm really pleased that we got a chance to talk. How are you tonight?
Thank you very much, Dan, for having me on your podcast. It's morning here in Japan, so good morning from here. And yeah, it's really a great honor to be able to come on here and talk about the wonderful Japanese giant salamanders and tell your listeners what's going on here, both good and bad.
I'm looking forward to it. I am. And it's interesting because having a guest on from Japan was actually easier because you're 13 hours ahead of me. Whereas when I have guests on in the UK, I think it's like 8 or 9 hours, depending on where I am, whether it's in the UK or continental Europe. And that's actually more of a struggle because I find that I have to interview people around 7 a.m. here to get them around 3 p.m. or 5 p.m. where they are. So this actually worked out really well.
Yeah, not too bad. It's just gone 8 a.m. I was in the river until almost midnight last night, so still do a little bit more sleep, but it's definitely a great reason to wake up early and have some coffee, for sure.
Indeed, indeed. So I was wondering if we could start off with you. Maybe tell us about your earliest experiences with the natural world. What drew you to Japan? Because you weren't born in Japan, but something drew you to Japan. And what led you to work with Japanese giant salamanders?
Okay, yeah, that's quite a long and winding story, but I'll try to make it as succinct as possible. So I'm English, British, and I grew up in the Cotswolds, which is a really stunning part of West England. Very old school, you know, it's 600-700-year-old houses on every street. It's really a wonderful place if you ever get a chance to go, if you haven't been already. I grew up in a village of 300 people. I went to a school which had, in total, I think I was the only boy in my school year when I started. It was that rural. So really, country origins. And I guess, you know, just living there gave me a great appreciation of nature. Plus, I'd also say that, you know, England's also obviously no paradise, but in terms of countryside management, now that I'm not living there and just go back for a visit, I think it is very good. It has a model of sustainability and longevity. You know, I'm pretty sure, you know, a few hundred years ago, most villages looked roughly the same as they do now, which is great. But probably for me, a big thing was a buddleia. What is that, a bush or a tree that was in the front garden of my family home? Do you know the buddleia?
I'm not familiar. No.
Okay, so that it's also known as the butterfly tree. So it attracts huge amounts of butterflies. So that was my first love, probably age about 4 years old. All these different butterflies coming, and then I got my first butterfly book, and you know, and got all geeky and nerdy at age four about identifying butterflies. Yeah, and that kind of developed into birds and mammals as I grew older. Not amphibians. Amphibians weren't on the kind of the radar until much later. Then I studied environmental management at university, and part of that was studying in Kenya, which I did for a short while. And that really was a dream come true. So Africa is probably my favorite place in the world in wildlife-wise, but it's pretty difficult to live there, I think. So Japan, really, I had zero interest and zero knowledge about Japan before I arrived here. I'd done a round-the-world trip by myself, age 24, which is 21 years ago, so you can work out how old I am. And during that travel, I met someone that had taught English in Japan, and I kind of logged that in the back of my mind and carried on. And then returning to a small village in the Cotswolds after being on the road for a year and having, you know, lots of freedom, suddenly I, you know, back in the parents' house with no money and an itch to get back out in the world. And suddenly I was like, oh yeah, what's someone said about a teaching program in Japan? So Google search, you know, found the application for the organization, applied. A few months later, I rocked up in Japan with literally zero knowledge, or, you know, just came here, try something new and get paid whilst doing it. Turns out, you know, I was placed in the most rural prefecture, well, the prefecture with the lowest population. And for me, that was a perfect fit. And there's a mountain here called Mount Daisen. And I'm actually, my house is on the lowest slopes of Mount Daisen. So I'm speaking from Mount Daisen, basically. I don't know, just something about Japanese mountains and the energy and the scenery and the whole package that really struck me and just felt right. If that's kind of, it's kind of weird to put into words, difficult, but, you know, it just felt like I should be here. Saying that, I did leave after a couple of years for more adventures, and I went to South Africa where I studied to be a safari guide and got my safari guide license. I also did voluntary research in the forests of Madagascar and Tanzania, and that was very cool. But then just a few events happened, and I ended up back in this area again. And then having returned, then I felt this again, this deep connection with the mountains here. And yeah, and then basically I've been here ever since that date of return. And that was, 2010? So that's, yeah, so the last 14 years, sorry, straight, I've been back. Yeah, and then, you know, I have experience in nature guiding and in some research as well, and travel, generally travel. So I branched out into being a guide for foreigners in Japan. First of all, it was, you know, standard tours with, you know, Tokyo and Kyoto and temples and that kind of thing. Sushi, if you like. But always I was trying to steer the tours and steer the companies that I worked for to be, you know, more considerate about the environment and also introducing the more rural areas and some of Japan's special wildlife, especially the region that I live in, purely on the fact that I'm a foreigner. I think it's amazing. Therefore, I think many other foreigners would think it's amazing if they came here because, you know, it's far away from the main sites. So it doesn't get a huge amount of foreigners. And then basically to get to the salamander part, because I had some, you know, experience and a reputation, a positive one, for, you know, being able to attract foreign visitors to this region, the management of the national park here, so Ministry of Environment workers, contacted me for some advice about how to appeal to the foreign market, the, you know, the non-Japanese visitor. And during those discussions, they asked me about, or they introduced to me about a Japanese giant salamander viewing tour and conservation tour that they'd been trying to get off the ground for a while, and asked me if I'd be interested to, you know, come along and give some advice about how to get that off the ground. And of course, I was like, yeah, please. Because to be honest, like, of course I knew about Japanese giant salamanders, but I really didn't consider for a second that it was viable to sort of just go in and look for them and find them with, you know, a relatively high percentage success rate, if that makes sense. So anyway, so, you know, next thing I know, I'm in this beautiful little village in the middle of nowhere, and with a leading expert, Dr. Okada. And I was introduced to Japanese giant salamanders, and I was blown away, to be honest. It was just an absolutely magical experience. And and I thought, wow, then, you know, people need, you know, to come and experience this. And also from, you know, meeting the researchers and finding out more about, you know, in depth about the situation for giant salamanders, I also discovered how terrible their conservation situation really is, especially in terms of people actually doing something active and productive about changing the situation and actually finding practical ways to tackle the issues that they face. So that led to me then forming a non-profit organization, which is called Sustainable Dyson, which is dedicated to the conservation of giant salamanders, but importantly focusing on the wider habitat. Because until now, there's been some efforts to protect and save the animal, but without any consideration given to, you know, the river, the farmland in the forest around the rivers. So, yeah, it was, you know, like I really, before I came to Japan, I was the least Japanophile, you know, I had zero interest in Japan. In my mind, it wasn't exotic enough in wildlife wise. So my appreciation and love from Japan, very organic in the sense it all came about after moving here. And also, to be honest with you, you might put me in the doghouse a little bit with your listeners, but I didn't have that much interest in amphibians before I got involved with the Japanese giant salamanders. Of course, you know, I love all types of creature. But I was, you know, into birds and mammals primarily, but now I'm definitely an amphibian convert, if you like. And I'm even doing a all Japan amphibian and reptile tour at the end of this month. So yeah, there you go. Sorry, that was a bit of a ramble, but hopefully it made some kind of sense.
No, absolutely. And you made a good point And there's actually two things I want to delve a little bit deeper in is for example, like as a non-native speaker, I went outside the U.S. a couple of times and I ended up in France, and not knowing the language was really, really, it put me at a disadvantage. And I honestly, I did not have a good time because I could not really communicate with anybody, and the people who did speak English generally weren't too happy that I didn't speak French. How was it assimilating into, because you've been there for what you said, like over 15 years. What was it like assimilating into just a day-to-day routine in Japan and just assimilating into Japanese culture?
This could be another, just this subject alone could be 10 podcasts long, to be honest, but I'll try to summarize. But you never assimilate into Japanese culture. And you'll always be an outsider. That sounds really cold and horrible, but to be honest, my view on it, it's very complicated. But especially as a European, Caucasian, that we're seen as kind of exotic and I don't know what's the word, high value foreigners. So you kind of get special treatment, if anything. To be honest, it's really difficult to be Japanese in Japan. And there's lots of, if you go online and look for, there's various podcasts from Japanese people talking about it, but they're very, very, it's very tough, the cultural pressure in Japan to succeed and loneliness levels and everything is really difficult. So it's a matter of coming to terms of who you are and accepting who you are and then living that life in Japan. Does that make sense at all? I'm not really, it is difficult to put into words. I think if you try to be Japanese, then that's when you get problems, because basically deep down you never will be. And that's fine, because I'm not. You know what I mean? Like my mentality is different. Although, as I welcome more and more foreign guests to Japan, I do see how my behavior is adapted to be more Japanese in a good way. You know, sort of general decorum and perhaps a little bit more respect for people's personal space and everything like that. You know, that's changed over the years. Does that make sense?
It does. And that is something that I'd heard from other people who I know who have spent significant time in Japan, that as, I mean, just for my perspective, as an American going to Japan, again, it's from what I understand, and I've heard this from multiple people, is that it is a very different cultural identity that stays very, very unique. And again, I know I have listeners in Japan, so if any of my listeners in Japan, you have input on this, by all means, I'd love to learn more about it, so feel free to reach out. But from what I understand, it is a very unique culture with a very unique set of values, and I have heard that you really, it's not like one day you magically become Japanese in every sense of the word. You retain who you are all along the way.
You retain who you are if you get your head around the fact that you'll never really be totally accepted. Well, I think accepted is probably a strong word, but like I said, I'm not, and I understand that as long as I have, legal rights and people aren't discriminate against me, then really I don't have a problem with it. And also I found, because I don't think the same, and kind of social control, societal control by peer pressure and shame is a big thing in Japan. And for example, if you complain about the problem, you are the problem. And I don't have that mentality, and I never will have, and I don't want to have. So if something is wrong, especially in terms of about environmental management, or something that's destroying nature, then I'm compulsed to talk about it and bring it up. I have to be careful about how I do it, because the Japanese way is quite non-direct. And if you're too direct about, even if you feel, that's terrible, you know, that people should be ashamed of doing that. It doesn't help to sit like that. And so I have a Japanese wife, and she's like, you know, my filter, if you like. And I've learned a lot from her. It's like, yeah, I understand, you know, she'll say, you know, I understand, and you're right. But, and other people also have said this, but if you approach it like that, then it's going to be, you know, you're not, people are going to just close the door. They don't want to face up to shameful behavior. So you need to kind of show more of the carrot than the stick, if you know what I mean.
I see that. Yeah. I want to mention one thing though, because this is kind of unique. You have a, you're an honorary monk, and you have a title they call you is, again, I'm going to try to pronounce the best I can, Yan Cha Bo, sure. Which is the bad boy monk. Can you tell us that story? Because that's pretty cool. You're an honorary monk, and I was wondering if you could talk to us about that, and as well as maybe kind of delve into your personal philosophy about nature.
Sure. I mean, I did say before, and I sometimes have to remind myself that, you know, I'm the most non-Japanese, they say, well, there's a term called Japanophile, where you're like a Japan nerd, whatever. You know, I have no interest in manga and popular culture and animation and all that kind of stuff. And I think, I'm really not into Japanese things. And then the other side is, I practice, I guess it can be classed as a religion, but I don't really like to think of it like as a religion. But there's an old... I guess you could say religion called Shugendo. And Shugendo is like mountain asceticism. So the basic belief is that, you know, mountains have power and energy, and nature has power and energy within it. And by doing kind of tough physical training and mental challenges within a mountain setting, you can reach a form of enlightenment, or, you know, living in the present moment. And sort of, it's again, like I call this like reverse meditation. So instead of sitting still and calming your breathing and clearing your mind, you go into nature, but with yourself or other practitioners, and you push yourself really hard and walk for 12 hours through the night from shrine to shrine chanting, and you just basically smash your brain into silence and then you find this kind of inner peace, your inner voice is quiet, and because you do it in that setting, you can feel the energy of the environment around you. And then just again, so Mount Dyson, where I live and I have this nonprofit organization, it's considered a god in itself, a great god mountain. But then just in the same region is another very significant, small in terms of physical size, but very large in terms of spiritual importance. There's a mountain called Mitoku-san, which has got a temple complex there. And I lived in the area and I became friends with a priest there many years ago. And we both worked together to try to promote the area the temple's in and the wider area. So I kind of got accepted in to that community. And then over the years, I got, you know, closer to them, and I helped them out after an earthquake by doing some setting up crowdfunding to pay for some repairs, that kind of thing. And just over the years, I've been invited into official ceremonies as a kind of honorary monk. And the Yan Cha Bo bit is, you know, it sort of means naughty boy monk or something. Just because my wife and the head priest shared a message that I was coming to the ceremony one day, and my wife said Yan Cha, which is like, oh, the naughty boy is coming. And that's to do with my kind of British sense of humor rather than actually, you know, doing terrible deeds. So the priest, the head priest thought that was pretty funny. And you know, that later that day, he presented me with an official monk's naming certificate saying Yan Chabot, which means bad boy monk. So, yeah. And really, I mean, it's a great honor, to be honest. And, I probably should feel some kind of imposter syndrome, because usually it's, you know, genuine Buddhist and Shugendo. It's all a bit of a blend. Priests and me doing the ceremonies and going into the sacred part of the temples where the general public are, you know, in the outer areas. But I don't feel imposter syndrome. I just feel kind of, you know, lucky, and I appreciate the opportunity and kind of just breathe it all in, really. And in terms of general philosophy for life and nature, I said this, it's classed as a religion of sorts, I guess, but it's not one singular entity casting judgment down. It's has its roots in Buddhism, and it has its roots in Shinto, which is similar to paganism, in the sense that all life, and even rocks actually, it's not even living things, have that universal energy flowing through it. And I feel that sometimes, and it's you know, I can understand people think that's complete nonsense and not scientific and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, especially, like I said, spending time in the mountains around here in this sacred region, like, it's just something you can't put into words. It's just a feeling and a sense that, you know, this kind of pure universal energy is running through everything, and you know, and all the animals and birds and trees and rocks and everything is all part of that, and basically they all appear to be in, you know, balanced, and whereas it's human beings that are not balanced. So I guess my approach to conservation has become kind of trying to connect Japan to its old self, which was much more harmonious with nature, and you know, living alongside nature was a major part of who they were. But basically, since the West came to Japan in around the 1880s or so, that's really changed, and they've, in my opinion, completely lost their way and have lost this connection to nature. They've just been completely divorced from it via, you know, consumerism and chasing the American dream, if you like. I mean, I'm British, so I appreciate that a lot of American ideals came from Britain as well, you know, that kind of industrialist kind of view where money first. So yeah, you know, that I'd been involved in conservation in Japan quite a long time before I actually realized myself that, oh yeah, you know, my beliefs and my connection with the old spiritual part of the Japanese culture and identity shapes what I do in terms of practical conservation work for animals within Japan.
It's interesting because that, what's the word I'm looking for? That I will call it a philosophy. That philosophy has been a pervasive one among guides. I've had a few guides on this show. Many of them were expatriates who lived either in the U.S. or in your case, you were from the U.K. who moved to a different part of the world, and for whatever reason gravitated towards a certain species or a certain biome or whatever, a certain place within that region. And in addition to the actual animals itself, that was the focus of any particular person's research or touring or whatever, the whole environment in and of itself became almost a living thing, where everything kind of coalesced into this whole experience. And I'm kind of talking about Josh Allen over in I think it's the Cordillera he's in Peru. And the same thing, okay. Just that very intimate understanding of what's around you. Because, I mean, to me, yeah, obviously the show is about amphibians, and we're going to cover the giant salamander in a minute. But I feel like setting the stage and the fact that you come into this as a guide is also a very, very interesting perspective, because you bring people to this place to help them get away from the, we want to say civilized or whatever, the hustle and bustle of urban, suburban life. You're going to lead them through this. And it's just, it rings true to what you said about people having sort of a disconnect between their everyday lives and this natural world that exists in some sort of balance. The fact that we have to, you know, contract someone to take us there. We can't just be there surrounded by it without having to make any kind of special plans.
I agree with that completely. It's taken me years of, you know, my actual own time going out into the rivers and finding these, you know, beautiful spots where there's a high chance of seeing salamanders as well. So it is not something that anyone can just do by themselves. I mean, theoretically, sure. I mean, it's not impossible, but you know, it's taken me hundreds of hours of searching to find the good places. So that's that, you know, I want to, you know, I'm able to be, you know, efficiently show people a beautiful and an amazing creature.
How did you feel the first time you saw one?
I was completely blown away. And part of the reason is that perhaps the image of Japanese giant salamanders is this sort of dragon or this huge beast living in this huge river or in a dark cave or something like that. But the reality is really different. And one of the most striking points was that the body of water that it was in, the first one, was probably, 20 centimeters deep. You'll have to do the inch conversion yourself. I'm sorry, it's about, 6 inches or something. So really shallow, and probably only about 2 meters, 7 foot wide. And then you've got this 70 centimeter, you know, 2.5 foot creature right there, you know. So, you know, it completely dominates its environment, you know. You've got a 70-centimeter creature in 20-centimeter deep water, in a stream that's only 2 meters wide. So I was like, "Wow, this is crazy." And then, as it happened, this salamander then sort of turned around. It was chilling, and then it kind of moved away. Did a 180 turn, and then sort of just slowly walked through my legs, brushing itself against my boot, and then, went on its merry way. And that level of just physical contact, even though it was through a wader, just really, you know, gave me this sort of special sensation and connection to them. And honestly, I felt, you know, okay, you know, this is a big moment, and I've been shown a sign that, you know, I have a connection with them, and I want to do my very best to help them. You know, I'm a bit of a hippie, really, I suppose. But it was a spiritual experience. That's what I can say. You know, it really touched my soul, not the soul of my boot, but the soul of my actual soul. So yes, it was really special. But then, you know, I was appreciator of all nature and all creatures, but I wasn't an amphibian specialist or enthusiast even. So I can imagine if you spend your whole life around amphibians and smaller salamanders, to experience seeing a giant one in the wild must be even stronger. You know, that the feeling must be even more intense than what I experienced.
I can only imagine. It's such an iconic species. I was wondering if you could tell us, maybe we could get into that as much as we can. Walk us through their life, their natural history, their habitat, their life cycle, how they breed, their diet. What makes a giant salamander a giant salamander?
Okay. Let me just, I'm just going to get the list of things you just set up to make it easier so I don't forget anything. I guess Japanese giant salamander is called a Japanese giant salamander because it's a giant living in Japan. That's the obvious bit there. So there's three types of giant salamander in the world, we could say. So they all make up the family, which is Cryptobranchidae. So in the US, you have the hellbender, which I'm sure you're aware of, obviously. And that, from my understanding, gets up to about 70 centimeters. So again, that's just under 2.5 foot. That's pretty decent size. But then the Chinese giant salamander is, again, there's a lot of confusion or debate about how many species there actually are and have been, but it's kind of recognized that there's three species of Chinese giant salamander. But unfortunately, due to basically them being harvested for food mostly and habitat degradation, the pure species of Chinese giant salamander are pretty much extinct now. Even in captivity, there's very few. But the Chinese, if you take those three species as, you know, one group, which we can call the Chinese giant salamander, technically they're the biggest. And they can grow up to 6 feet, 180 centimeters, which is obviously crazy big. And then you've got the Japanese giant salamander, which is one singular species. It can grow up to around about 5 foot, so 150 centimeters. It can weigh anything up to 32 kilograms. I've no idea what that is in pounds, I'm sorry. There's a lot of things that are unknown about giant salamanders, to be honest, because there hasn't been that much research, unfortunately. We can get into that reasons why later on. But what we do know, so probably, and, you know, it hasn't been recorded exactly yet, but probably they can live up to 100 years or even more, which is insane. Where do we go from here? So from the beginning, I guess. So breeding season is late August into September. And from around about, from my experience, late May into June through to late July, they move where they can up the rivers into tributaries and find a preferred breeding nest. And then the most dominant male, which is called the den master or the nushi in Japanese, will guard and, well, first arrive. You know, this is a breeding nest that is used for multiple years. They arrive, they clean it out, and they wait for the females to come. During that time, other males will try to take over the nest, and they have really brutal battles between the dominant males. But the den master will win out for a number of years. This old warrior, the toughest guy in the river. And eventually, the females will arrive and the females will enter the nest. It's thought that probably at that time, again, this isn't 100% proven, it's kind of accepted that the females release a pheromone, which calms the male. And then the females enter, they deposit eggs anywhere between 250 to 750 eggs at one time, and then depart. And that's their parenting done, if that counts as parenting. Multiple females can enter, so sometimes up to sort of two or three can enter. So you've got even around 1,000 eggs in the nest at that time. And then interestingly, during this time when, you know, the dominant male is in the nest and the females have come in, there's other smaller males wait around the breeding nest. And then when the male seems to be kind of under the influence of this pheromone, these other males sneak in, deposit their own goodness onto the eggs, and then depart. And those males are called sneakers, which I think is pretty funny, because they sneak in and then disappear. So then the male, so this is the ultimate warrior, the toughest guy in the whole setup, will then look after the nest, the eggs, and the hatchlings, the larvae, for up to 7 months. So that basically means that the father, the toughest, the ultimate top warrior, will be a dad and, you know, staying around the nest area for up to 7 months of every year. So that means only 5 months of the year is actually out and about, you know, building its strength up, ready for the next, you know, battle season and parenting season. So that's quite a unique behavior. And then, yeah, moving on. So they're very slow growing animals. The larvae will enter the river, the main stream or river after about six months or so. And then they maintain their gills for a couple of years. But they don't actually reach breeding age until, again, it's not really known for sure, in captivity, where they have kind of more ideal and kind of constant conditions, that they have been shown to breed from around 15 years old, which is actually pretty late, I think, as compared to most species. You know, technically humans can do it much earlier, shouldn't perhaps, but yeah, so, but, you know, in the wild, perhaps, again, not really known, but they could be even 20 or 25 years old before some mature enough to breed. Yeah, what else? So prey, pretty much, what do they eat? Pretty much anything meat-like. So they're 100% carnivorous. Their main diet consists of fish, frogs, soft-shelled crabs, but, you know, they've been known to eat snakes, huge snakes, moles, and just here's, you know, just so you can gauge that meat is meat for them. Well, two things, actually. So one was that one researcher flushed the stomach of one individual just to, you know, for research purposes, and out pops a kitten that was within a plastic carrier bag, plastic bag, shopping bag. So obviously some horrible person had drowned this kitten in a plastic bag, and it's come floating past the salamander, which has obviously detected that it's meat, and it's just swallowed the whole thing up. But also they cannibalize as well. There was a case within the last couple of years of, so when we do collect biometrics for salamanders, we often put in a pit tag, which has its own, you know, like a barcode almost. So you scan it using a pit code reader and it tells you a number. So then, you know, if you find that same same individual elsewhere, you're able to recognize that one. So anyway, so scans this about 80 centimeter giant salamander. Beep, okay, it's a recapture. And they check the records. It was like, wait a minute, like you were 40 centimeters not so long ago. Like, how can that be? How have you grown so fast? And then so did another scan and beep. Okay, so what had happened was this 80-centimeter giant salamander had swallowed a 40-centimeter giant salamander. So that was both of the pit types came up when the researchers scanned it. So yeah, pretty much, you know, anything meat like they will consume it.
That's a wild story.
Yeah, they're ambush predators. So this is why you can find them in the middle of the stream. I'm not sure, to be honest, how this compares to other salamander species, but you know, they'll move into the river. They look pretty much exactly like the bottom of the river or rock, and they just wait. And then they use this very special feeding suction technique where they'll detect, you know, fish or prey around the head area, not using the eyes, but using other senses. And they basically build up pressure. And then because their top and lower jaws are like two plates, and they basically build up this pressure, and then they just go, and they suck the whole fish or frog or whatever it is, or kitten in a bag, and take it all in with a lot of water at the same time. And it's incredible to view. Actually, I've got a couple of cases of, you know, a couple of videos I was lucky enough to catch doing it on Instagram, and so if you can check it out on there. Yeah, and what was I saying? Sorry, lost my chain of thought because my dog's whimpering in the background. So they either, you know, wait and they suck it all down, or I've recorded a couple of times where they just very fast, and they'll catch hold of the tail of a fish, and then you can see them just sort of rocking, building pressure, and then, like the click of your fingers, this fish just disappears down its throat. It's very cool and very, very impressive thing to witness in the wild for sure. What else do we need to cover in terms of its biology, I wonder?
Well, a few follow-up questions. Yeah, I'm curious about their population density, because you enlighten me because you're the expert, obviously, but from the footage I've seen, they generally or seem to be in relatively shallow, relatively not super wide, clear streams. So for an animal that size that eats as much as it does, where are the other ones? I mean, are they very population dense? And it seems like they produce a fair amount of offspring every year. Do we know how many of those survive to make it to adulthood?
So yeah, to answer your question about the density, is the fact that during the breeding season and around the breeding nest, that, you know, the preferred one that's used for multiple years, they are extremely territorial. But outside of breeding season, they can be really quite close to each other, especially in some of these the mountain streams around here. I've been lucky enough to find sort of within a 1 kilometer stretch. So what's that? Like just under a mile, 23 individuals. And some of them are really, you know, just a meter or less apart. So they're outside of the breeding season, they pretty much ignore each other unless a big one eats a little one. Basically, it depends on the individual river system and, you know, the general environment in which they're in. But in sort of the more degraded habitats, I often see giant salamanders literally side by side. So, outside the breeding season, they're pretty sedentary, to be honest. But, yeah, the more the sort of more pristine habitats, generally, there's a little bit of space between them, but again, you know, case by case.
Do they have any natural predators as an adult, I can't imagine they're going to have any besides people, but going through their larval stage into their subadult stage, is there anything that feeds on them?
Sorry, during which stage?
Well, during any of the stages, you know, from when they're really small as larvae to subadults, I mean, is what in the area considers them to be food?
Very few. I mean, for when the larval stage, yeah, I mean, fish, birds potentially. But to be honest, I rarely see any kind of heron or egrets or anything like that in around the good habitats because they're mostly in forested areas. But yeah, other salamanders for sure. You know, if an 80 centimeter one will eat a 40 centimeter one, it's definitely going to eat a 5 to 10, 15 centimeter one for sure. So I probably the other giant salamanders are the biggest threat to them when they're young. But as adults, yeah, there's no natural predator for them. Natural predator, is that the word I'm looking for? Yeah, they're not eaten or hunted by anything other than and humans now, basically, that's kind of, as far as I'm aware, that the harvesting of giant salamanders for food has stopped in Japan. But there used to be a river otter, but that's believed to be extinct now for about 100 years. So it's thought that the river otter probably predated on the Japanese giant salamander. But nothing is confirmed for sure. Although just last night I heard from someone that just a couple of years ago, some researchers found droppings that they suspected to be the Japanese river otter, actually, even though it's, you know, thought to have been extinct for so long. So it's potentially it could be another one that actually there might be a small pocket of the otters left, but nothing that's going to be a problem for the salamanders for sure. And it actually, what's great, I mean, there's the big problem of feral cats in Japan, and the salamanders seem to be one species that they don't kill. They kill everything else, but not the giant salamanders, as far as I can see.
Tell us about the region of Mount Dyson in some detail, because I'm curious about the habitat that these giant Japanese salamanders occupy. If you could just in detail kind of walk us through what the area looks like, maybe, I don't know if you can tell us how cold the water is, how fast it flows, plants, terrain. Give us as best a picture as you can of what this area looks like.
Okay. So, yeah, Mount Dyson. So Mount Dyson, so Japanese words are made up of basically Chinese characters. They're called all kanji, and the characters for Mount Dyson are great or big and mountain. So it's more significant is the great part, and up until about 800 years ago it was called the Great God Mountain. I mean, mountains are worshipped across Japan and have been, you know, historically, but Mount Dyson is the only one that I can see. Well, there is another one near Tokyo, but it's specifically known as the Great God Mountain. And then, you know, now it's the Great Mountain. And it rises directly from the Sea of Japan, which is very significant in terms of the fauna and flora that's found here, including the Japanese giant salamanders. So the Sea of Japan has currents that come up, and that brings with it a lot of moist air. So this region gets a lot of precipitation and snow, especially during the winter months. So Mount Dyson is 1,700 and change high. But above a certain point in winter, it has the same weather as mountains that are over 3,000 meters high, which is really, and like I do hiking there, and I put on the how do you call that in English? The cleats, the, you know, the hiking spikes, they're called aizen in Japanese. Is it cleats? Yeah, I forget English words these days, I'm afraid. So anyway, it's like this complete alien environment in winter, and, you know, and thick snow and ice. And then, so basically the rivers of Mount Dyson
are mostly snow melt, which obviously means that they're cool and clean generally. When towards the top especially, and obviously amphibians, the Japanese giant salamander, need highly
oxygenated.
Water, and yeah, so that needs to be cool. And then basically, because this mountain Daisen rises literally directly from the ocean, that means that this cool water, this oxygen-rich water, flows pretty much all the way down to the until it enters the ocean, which means that salamanders can be found almost at sea level. And that's very rare. But what makes more rare is that this area has what's believed to be at least the lowest altitude breeding grounds for any giant salamander species anywhere in the world. And that's because of these unique conditions, you know, this huge landmass coming up from this, straight from the ocean, which has, you know, currents, which brings a lot of moisture. And then another significant point about Mount Daisen is that because it was revered as a god, the area around the peak, which is where some of the temples are and the shrines, were kind of off limits to the general public for centuries, even till a couple of hundred years ago, really. So what that actually meant is that because it was sacred ground, the forests over the centuries were not cleared. Whereas, you know, Japan is famously a warring nation, and, you know, free metal, you know, wood was very important for making an army and weapons. But basically the beech forests, particularly around the peak of Mount Daisen, were spared the mass felling that happened around the rest of the country. And beech trees are very good at filtering water, that they have deep root systems, they hold it. So you've got this combination of these ancient beech forests on the upper areas of a mountain that receives a high amount of snow and precipitation that's right next to the ocean. So again, this is like the perfect conditions for clean, oxygen-rich, cool water flowing all the way down to the bottom and into the ocean, which also means the areas around the river mouse, or at least historically, were very rich as well in terms of biodiversity. Generally breeding grounds for giant salamanders are more up around the mid to upper areas of the river systems. So, and normally that's at least sort of 400 meters above sea level, and, you know, hours away by car from the ocean more often than not. Whereas here, you know, I can go from literally the ocean, an ocean village, to the breeding ground within 10 minutes by car. And we're talking 50 meters above sea level or something like that. So it's a really special, unique place. And it's believed, again, this is just a theory, that during the ice ages, the mainland was connected. The ocean levels, sea levels dropped during the ice age, which connected some islands called the Oki Islands near here to the mainland. And basically the rivers that came out from the mainland extended out as far as these islands, and with them came the salamanders. And then also the Daisen rivers would have converged at some point. And then as the sea levels rose, you know, the salamanders became isolated in the Mount Daisen area. Luckily, or was probably not luck, it is what it is. But because of these great conditions of the pure water, because of the snow and because of the beech forest, that meant that the salamanders were able and have been able to thrive in this, you know, unique but yet very relatively small area, because the rivers of Dyson are only from top to bottom a couple of miles long, some of them. So it's really quite small, but with, you know, historically healthy populations. What else is there? I think that pretty much covers it. But just again, these conditions of it being a sacred mountain and a huge landmass next to the ocean means it's very has very rich biodiversity.
Tell us about some of the threats they face from a human element. We talked about predators, but the human element seems to be the most substantial. And some of the projects that are going on at Sustainable, maybe kind of walk us through what the threats are, how they're identified, and the projects you're using to address them.
Okay. I mean, you can basically, all of the problems they face are connected to activity, 100%. I mean, that's probably the same for most people, you break it down. But we can kind of categorize the threats into three different parts. So the first one is, and arguably and probably the biggest threat to the future of the Japanese giant salamander, is hybridization with Chinese giant salamanders. So in 1952, the giant salamanders were being harvested at a rate for food at a rate that was unsustainable, and it was, you know, they were the population massively dropped nationwide. I mean, this is post World War II. It's a convenient protein source. I get all of that. But anyway, since 1952, they've been considered a special natural treasure or monument of Japan, and with that comes some protection that only licensed people can touch them. Saying that, not one single person has ever been charged with breaking that rule. So it's more of the, you know, say it and most Japanese will follow. So that's a kind of good point with Japanese culture, I guess. So basically the demand for meat and then certainly any kind of market for the meat disappeared. So this is the 1950s. Then in the early 1970s, seemingly one businessman, Japanese, from a region called Okayama, which is quite near here, he brought over, or his group or whatever, 800 Chinese giant salamanders as a way of kind of getting around the rules. So obviously the Chinese giant salamander is not a native species and therefore would not have any protection and does not have any protection in Japan. So the goal was to, you know, farm them for meat in the same way they do in mainland China, even up to the, you know, these days it's still a thing. But then the Japanese government sort of rightly pointed out, or, you know, decided that the normal folk, especially once the meat is processed, have no idea if it's Chinese giant salamander meat or the native ones. So obviously that would, if there was a market for the meat, that would put native populations at risk of people just going out and harvesting them. Yeah. So it was decided, no, you can't do that. But seemingly, you know, there wasn't actually a plan then made to what to do with these giant salamanders, these Chinese. So basically they were released into the wild. So now you've got 800 individuals or however many were left deposited into rivers and water, bodies of water around Japan, including one famously in the moat of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. One even showed up there. And over time, they've bred with the Japanese giant salamander and created a hybrid mongrel offspring. And these hybrids are considerably more aggressive and stronger than either of the parent species. So what that's meant is that where they've been able to thrive, They've basically pushed out the native population of Japanese giant salamanders. And a prime example is Kyoto. And then if any of your listeners have been to Japan, they've probably been to Kyoto. There's a famous bridge that goes over the Kamo River into the kind of district called Gion. Anyway, that river, they've done eDNA testing. So they took samples of water and were able to detect that in the whole river system, the hybrid population makes up over 98% of the salamanders in that whole river system. And that's over basically a relatively short period of time. So once the hybrids are in there, they're out competing the native species, and then the native species is disappearing from many river systems. So that's a huge threat. And even some researchers think that probably the population of hybrid animals, which isn't a Japanese giant salamander, basically is probably now larger than the native population. It's not the fact, it's kind of people's stupidity that's pushing this along as well, because, you know, native species and other ones have been found in rivers over, you know, periods of time that are so far apart that the only way they could be possibly getting there is if people are picking them up and moving them. Or probably, we guess, maybe they're, you know, oh, giant salamander is a cool pet, put it in their bathtub in their apartment, and then realize, oh, that's not such a good idea, go and dump it in a different river system. So that's the huge threat for the future of Japanese giant salamanders overall. However, so Daisen salamanders and even Tottori, you know, it's an isolated region. And then the Daisen, the Nawa River basin within Daisen, is an island population within a remote area. Island as in it's separated, not, you know, it's not a small island in itself. So in terms of hybridization, we certainly feel that this area should be a conservation priority to actually maintaining the Japanese giant salamander as an individual species. However, so that's number one. That's the hybrid problem. Second, and certainly, and it's the biggest one in this area, is habitat fragmentation. So the Japanese government model is known as the concrete state. So it's based around this outdated kind of belief system that construction is at the heart of civilization and being civilized as a nation. So this constant funneling of government funds for concrete, for needless often construction projects, be it a new, you know, many cases around here, a village with only half a dozen people living in it, new road. So way less cars, way less people, perfectly good road, way better than British and American roads. Oh, let's build a bypass around this village. It's like crazy. And then the other thing they've done is concrete up the side of rivers for the supposedly flood control. And also they've installed weirs. Do you know what I mean by a weir?
Yes, like I do.
Like an agricultural dam. So basically, if you imagine, a river, just listeners, within the river course itself, you've got concrete steps, walls, waterfalls, or whatever you want to call it, fragmenting that the river. And what happens, and it's a huge problem here, is that the salamanders, during heavy rains especially, or even by their own accord, move or get flushed down the river, and they're unable to move back up to breed. And unfortunately, especially, you know, from May, June, July, I can find many exhausted salamanders trying to claw their way up. They don't have claws, but, you know, rubbing their feet up against these weirs night after night, year upon year, trying to, you know, in vain to get up the river to breed. You know, you even find them with sort of the skin hanging off the bottom of the feet. You can find them just like completely zonked out, exhausted, next to these weirs where, you know, they've tried in vain for hours. So that's a huge, huge problem for this area. The third one, and I'll come back to the habitat fragmentation in just a second. The third one is, you know, kind of standard global issue with pollution, and especially animal farming, very slack rules around Japan because, you know, meat industry came from the West and it's, you know, how to make money quickly, and they don't have proper waste management practices. So a lot of the animal dung, waste, poo, manure, whatever, ends up in the river directly from the animal farms, or it is put into the ground by the ton and sort of say, oh, it's fertilizer, when it's clearly not. It's just a dumping of industrial waste, and they slip the farmers some cash. So that's resulting in a lot of nitrates and, you know, phosphorus and other things, which basically then results in the growth of algae and other, you know, watercress, which removes oxygen from the water. But going back to that, so there's not, you know, apart from kind of revealing what's going on and trying to push the government for stricter regulation, which is obviously really difficult to tackle the pollution problem. The other thing we're more focused on is the trying to solve the habitat fragmentation issue. And they basically there is a way to fix it. You know, we're not talking about, you know, the tiger where we need to conserve 1,000 hectares or more, or whatever it is, you know, of forest. We're talking about building ramps for fish, you know, for salamanders and the prey to be able to move freely within the river system. And yeah, one of the things we've done about that is in the feeder rivers, which are actually really important breeding ground, with the help of the US Marines, would you believe, we've built, you know, man-made ramps for the salamanders to climb up these weirs by basically picking up heavy rocks in the area and stacking them up. And the US Marines have been amazing. There's a lot of the US military posted in Japan. Maybe people know that or not, but, you know, tens of thousands, I guess. I'm not really sure. And one base called Iwakuni, which is near Hiroshima. Yeah, every year for the last couple of years, and then also in a couple of weeks' time, a group of 10 to 20 military personnel have come up and have acted as kind of conservation force. And, you know, the ultimate volunteer force. You've got super enthusiastic, strong people that enjoy picking up heavy stuff. So, yeah, so together, you know, I was able to convince the prefecture that, you know, these ramps were a good way to kind of work, you know, solve the problem of habitat fragmentation for the salamanders in the feeder rivers. However, you know, within the main river, so that's the Nawa River itself, the water flow is such during heavy rains that temporary structures of piled up rocks wouldn't be sufficient, and then these rocks could get washed down themselves and block up irrigation channels, and then that would be, you know, being, you know, sued by farmers and all that kind of stuff. So what we need is properly engineered concrete or steel sort of fish ladders or bypass ramps built next to these weirs so everything can move up and down. So that's basically a big project we're working on now, and Project Big, I've just decided to call it. And basically what we're going to be doing now is trying to get private money from around the world through fundraising, you know, even hopefully some Japanese businesses to pay for each individual weir, especially connecting the tributaries. So if each one, you know, we're not sure, we're in the planning stages now, we have to convince the prefecture to let us do it, even though it makes no sense for them to say no. but you know, it's red tape and everything. So basically, we want to install these privately funded ramps within the whole river system. Ideally, we could do every single one, every single weir, but we're talking in the Nahwa River alone, I've counted 53. So if each one is $5,000 to $10,000 or more, you know, that's a lot of money. But that's something we're working on from now. And a kind of really big point for and big moment for our organization, Sustainable Dyson, is going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks. In the fact, we're having a government policy recommendation published in a journal called scientific journal called Frontiers, a peer reviewed paper. And let me just, I should know the actual name of it. Let me just get that up for a second, if I may. So I don't want to get the title wrong. It is called, where have we got? Here we go. Protecting Japanese Giant Salamanders, Andreas Japonicus, in the Nahwa River Basin, Japan. Policy recommendations addressing water pollution and waterway disruption. So the local government and regional government have sometimes cited a lack of data as a reason for them not doing anything, which is nonsense, because it's evident, you know, you can go to these weirs and see the salamanders, you know, night upon night in before the breeding season, trying to get up the weirs. There's other reports and papers written elsewhere in Japan about the problem. But by doing this collaborative research paper, this policy recommendation paper, we can show exactly, you know, what the issue is and ways to address it. And we've done that by working with basically, I would say, like the top amphibian researchers in the world, including, so a two co-authors are the joint chairs for the IUCN amphibian SSC amphibian specialist group, and especially Professor Amel Bourzé. He's been a real friend for us and has visited many times and worked on this research. Then also a leading Japanese researcher as well. So we've gone, you know, we've listened, oh, there's no research, and there hasn't been any research. And we've organized it, we've managed to get the world's leading amphibian specialists to come. And we did intensive research last year. My own research over the last few years is included as data in this report. And then, you know, we're going to go. Hopefully they're going to listen. It might take some pushing, you know, media involvement or whatever to get them to realize that I'm not going to go away. Is present this and then at the same time say, you know, this is what I talked about, the Japanese, you've got to show the carrot, not just the stick. Be like, okay, yeah, there you go. Let's together find a way, even though you're not doing anything when you're supposed to be doing anything. Yeah, so let's do something positive. So we're going to get all this overseas and private money, and we're going to, you know, it's going to help the construction companies, and we're going to build these ramps for the good of nature and the good of the town. And yeah, that's the huge plan that's sort of will be moving forward with, even within the next few weeks. And then hopefully we can have some ramps built within a year or two. Does that make sense? I kind of rambled on for a long time.
No, it does. That does make sense. And it, part of it also answers another question that I was planning on asking you, was the focus on or the different approaches between in situ versus ex situ conservation. And like from what I've gathered throughout the course of our discussion is that gathering up a bunch of giant salamanders and captive breeding them in a warehouse somewhere is not the answer. It's the environment that they live in and exist in now has to be the priority, as opposed to just trying to Noah's Ark them off somewhere else and then reintroduce them later, particularly the area that you're in.
Yes. I mean, it should be the priority. Unfortunately, Japan has got previous in, let's say, letting species go extinct and then reintroducing them later to some success. But, you know, not all species that is not capable of doing that. One would be the toki, which is, what is that? The type of, I know the Japanese word and not the English one. It's a stork, I think. No, it isn't. That's a different one. The species, there is a type of stork that was extinct, and then they reintroduced it because it also was found on in China as well. But yes, there absolutely should be focus on protecting the existing populations. There are breeding programs in Japan, and I'm working closely with Dr. Yuki Taguchi, who until just a couple of weeks ago was working, you know, for several years at a facility that is one of only two successful breeding programs in the world. Now he's setting up his own salamander kind of research institute with my help. But basically, yeah, it comes down to environmental education and jobs within conservation, and the general attitude of the Japanese government is one that is basically pretty awful when it comes to, you know, practical nature conservation. There's very little environmental education for any age, including children. There's very few jobs in ecology or environmental management within Japan. So if to progress within that field, people basically have to move away, and generally, as in, move overseas. And when that happens, they generally don't come back. So, you know, there kind of needs to be a huge cultural change for Japan to be able to move forward and actually effectively conserve nature, which is why it's been so important for my organization and myself to get international attention and support. Did I answer your question? Did I ramble on again?
No, you did. And I mean, again, that's also, I think, kind of a theme of the greater part of our discussion here. What I was going to ask was, as a follow-up to that, was the value of community engagement, because the story you're telling me is, I've heard this story in other parts of the world, and it seems to be the same, is that there's not a tremendous amount of interest in conserving something. And I feel like that might just be a universal, but it's for any number of reasons that I'm sure vary from location to location. But the value that community engagement has to spearhead this type of initiative, what role does that have, and what initiatives are you taking at Sustainable Dyson to engage the local community?
Yeah, so this is a big challenge for us because, like I've talked about many times, that reaching the international community has proven to be successful beyond my possible, you know, my imagination, really. You know, having the world's best researchers come collaborate like that, people coming all over the world to viewing and conservation tours. Couldn't have hoped the international angle, you know, it's way further down the line than I could possibly dare to dream. But on a local sense, it's a much, much bigger challenge. So, yeah, if you take the local community, the very localized community, so the villages or the one village around the breeding areas that I've been talking about, very typical within Japan, aging population, lots of empty houses. Probably the average age is over 70. A few small children, but nothing in between. So, you know, a lot of, you know, most of these villages aren't going to exist within a generation. So, you know, there's other issues there. And the local farmers, and they're mostly farmers, you know, rice and you know, kind of small scale. But they've told me directly, and honestly, you know, we're not that interested in Japanese giant salamanders because they exist in other rivers. And, you know, we don't see them, especially because within the village area, the river has become this concrete channel, you know, concrete both sides with these weirs going up through there. So it's not, you know, a beautiful river habitat, you know, that they can connect to, you know, on a spiritual level or anything. So then we have to be kind of, you know, I kind of appreciate that honesty as well, to be honest. Okay, that's what it is. That's what we're dealing with. So how do we connect with them? So one of the things that I talked about before is the need to protect the wider habitat. So that's not just the rivers, not just the species, but like the farmland and the forests around them, around the rivers, you know. And one of the things we've done as an organization is in an area that it's we've recognized is a really important place with breeding behavior. There's a series of about 8 rice fields. Well, it used to be rice fields that haven't been farmed for many, many years. So we were able, with the help of a local farmer, find all of the owners, which took a lot of work and research of all these different fields, and make it a group agreement to basically manage these fields. And what we're doing is basically we're doing some organic farming projects to basically show the local community that organic farming is possible despite what years of you know, chemical industry and government people telling them it's possible. But also just to kind of to create even the parts that we're not using, to cut out the vines and the spiky under growth and basically make it an area that's good for biodiversity. So that's something we're working on now. And we've already grown some vegetables, and we've cut out the vines and the spiky weeds, and natural grasses and flowers are coming back, which means more frogs, more newts, more everything, more, you know, insects. And basically the salamanders are right in the river next to there. So as the apex predator, anything meat like that drops in the river is potential food for the salamanders. So we're working with the local community to kind of manage a bit of land that has kind of fallen into disrepair, if land can be, you know, in that state. And also then, you know, for Japanese people and those local farmers, sounds kind of simple and crazy, but cutting the grass with a, what do you call it in America, a bushwhacker, strimmer in English, you know, a machine that you hold and it cuts the grass, not a lawnmower. Do you know what I mean? Is it bushwhacker?
A weed whacker or an edger.
Weed whacker, that's the boy. Yeah, so even, you know, we help them cut the grass around the village. And then I got a call a couple months, maybe a month ago, because they know we have, like, volunteers come from all over the world to help with the organic farming projects and stuff and some conservation stuff. So we have young, fit people that with a positive attitude. So we help them with their you know, their village cleaning. So, you know, together we all, you know, with the old guys, we shoveled the leaves out of the irrigation channels for the rice fields. So by doing that, we show that, you know, and then, you know, who are they? Oh, Sustainable Dyson. Well, what are they doing? Oh, they're, you know, they're involved in it's Japanese giant salamander conservation. Oh, okay. And by helping them, we're creating a positive image of us and the volunteers coming, and also showing what, oh, this guy's come from Uruguay, this girl has come from the US or Germany or Australia, and like, really, are they coming all this way to help with conserving an animal within our, you know, locality? So that's the kind of, you know, you have to be kind of imaginative, you know. So there are local, there have been local Japanese giant salamander so-called conservation groups around for decades, but they don't do anything. It's all talking. I mean, some probably do. I don't want to say none of them do anything, but certainly the ones here I even asked the local government officials who were technically responsible, you know, what's that group done? Like, I can't understand it. Like, I don't know. They've never contacted us. So it's just this image, and this is a big problem in Japan. The image of doing something, the pretense of doing something is important, but for them. But in terms of actually saving the animal, it's counterproductive because other local people who might have a concern look at it and go, oh, well, there's that group, you know, set up the you know, and the, oh, they must be fine then. And they're not. So it's really awful situation, actually, these groups. Like, I don't even understand. I don't want to get into that kind of talk too much. But so in terms of local groups set up to do conservation, my experience is that they aren't doing enough, if I'm being nice. But so in reaching the local population, we need to be creative and do something and help them with their daily lives so they can understand, you know, at least know about who we are and what we're trying to do.
Well, I mean, that does resonate resonates here too. People who cry crocodile tears for some cause just so that they can virtue signal for their own agenda, or it's easier and cheaper to go out and say I support XYZ than actually go there and physically do it. And that's I've heard that here in the US and in other countries as well. Even forget everything else, but even especially with regards to conservation, that's something that happens on a global level. And
ego, right? That's what it is. And honestly, I consider these people the worst kind of people there are. It's better if the people that aren't doing anything are better than the people that are virtue signaling and pretending that they are doing something, you know what I mean? So, yes. And actually, sorry to sort of go off on one here, but, you know, everyone has ego, but everybody should try to control their ego, I think. And that's that kind of mountain monk training, you know, that connects back to that. You know, you need to be, you know, pushing your mind to a point where it's, you know, you challenge everything about yourself. And if you're acting from ego, you need to change. But you first need to be in a state of mind where you're able to kind of look at yourself and go, you know, why am I doing things? Is it for me, or is it for the animals, or is it for the greater good? And if it's for you, stop it and change it, or just at least stop it. So, yes, sorry.
I tell people the same thing. I say, look, don't look at me. Don't look at me. Don't look at me and what I'm doing. Just look at what I'm doing. Forget me. Mm. Just look at this.
Yeah.
And it's a hard sell with people. It just is. I don't know. It's just a quirk to our being human. I don't really know. And again, it's just not. I mean, this is kind of making me sound like an egotistical jerk anyway. But just through my proselytizing.
So at least you're aware of it. That's the point. Yeah. Self-awareness, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, you're challenging your own kind of belief system and reasons for doing stuff. But, you know, normally I find these people are kind of a whole. And it's a big thing in Japanese society, actually, is that people are missing that, you know, that they're missing that something important in their life. So they'll latch on to a cause and then feel like they're an authority in it, or that, but they're not doing it. They're just kind of presenting the image of doing it. And that's very destructive. But it comes down to something missing in their life or their soul. So I probably should sow empathy and sympathy or something, but nah. Sort yourself out. That's you know, just please, for the good of the world. If you're going to say you're talking, if you're going to talk about it, do it, or shut up and let, you know, don't convince other people that, you know, people are looking after the things that when they're not.
Yeah. Well, sorry. Richard, we're kind of at the end, but I wanted to ask you, in a perfect world.
Yeah.
Well, we'll kind of go about this in a two-pronged approach. In a perfect world, where would you like to see the Japanese giant salamander 10 years from now? And in you know, given the way things are, what would be the worst case scenario 10 years from now if things were to go badly?
Right. Well, obviously, we don't live in a perfect world, so that one. But so, I mean, it's definitely possible that the Japanese giant salamander, which has basically existed in its present form for 23 million years, there's a strong chance, unless things change, that they could disappear from planet Earth within the next 20. Singular. Not 20 million, 20 singular years. So what needs to change is, well, how do I even start? I mean, Japanese society, is that too much of a broad term? But Japanese government approach and Japanese people's understanding of what's going on. So spreading the word and increased environmental education is really important to be able to tell Japanese people there's a huge, huge, huge problem here. The Japanese, you know, this senpai kohai, this structure where the master and the apprentice, this kind of Confucian-based older must be, you know, the elders must be respected even if they don't deserve it kind of mentality needs to change. You know, when something is bad, recognize it and say it and stand up and change and do something about it. So, and the case with the giant salamanders, again, it needs to be first recognition of how dire the situation is in terms of the, especially with habitat fragmentation in these precious habitats, because it can be fixed. If there's enough public will and government will, then it could be done. We're talking about a country that loves concrete. Or put some concrete in front of the concrete. Do you know what I mean? So this is a big thing. It's like build a ramp. It can be concrete in front of the concrete ramp. But no, apparently that's not for, you know, the public good. Well, I don't know what, you know, it's a special natural monument. So I can't, you know, I literally had a politician tell me, money's a problem because it's not for the public good. So, you know, just changing the mentality and opening people's eyes to what's really the condition of Japan. And that goes for international people too. Like we touched on earlier, maybe it was just in our private chat, but like this image of Japan being this kind of, I don't know, Zen-like Vulcan homeworld where everything's calm and everyone's connected to nature and everything's great is really not true. And it's actually very detrimental. This bubble, this illusion that everything's great in Japan needs to stop. It's not the worst country, but it's not the best country. You know, it has some amazing points, but it has some really big challenges and terrible points. And we need to talk about it. We need to, you know, it's not necessarily shameful. We have got to be careful about shaming people, or as my wife tells me. But we need to face up to the fact that things haven't been done well in the past, so that we can change and do something more positive and better, you know, in the present. So if I like, let's find something positive. So I hope and I'm confident that we'll be able to make Dyson and sustainable Dyson's kind of study area, the Nawa River Basin, a kind of model for how to fix a situation as much as it's possible with, you know, bypass ramps, privately funded throughout the whole river network, and have that be a kind of a model that other people can follow within Japan. It doesn't even have to be for giant salamanders. It could be, you know, issues with bears, and it's just a kind of better understanding of what's going on and recognizing that things need to change.
Well, I mean, I guess what we can do is just, like, people say, oh, all we can do is hope. Don't hope, actually do something. And the fact that you're doing something, and the fact that there's an initiative is an important thing. And you know, I think that the work that you're doing is important, and it's vital. And I mean, even for me, some, you know, bozo halfway across the planet, I hold value in it. And I think that something like this is interesting. And to have something that's so unique and so iconic, and not even like, it's not even like the land is getting just like, you know, burned down or catastrophic. I mean, like the way we have in some other, it has the potential to be managed very well with all the resources that Japan has,
yeah.
But it's not. So, you know, that's, yes. That's a whole different challenge.
Yeah, that's the reality. Yeah, I mean, I want to say, like, I mean, I hope I don't come across as kind of too negative, because certainly, you know, being involved in Japanese giant salamander conservation and ecotourism, and having, you know, especially for anyone that, you know, just likes nature, going in and seeing them in the wild is very, it can be very rewarding for me, you know, like especially people that are into amphibians. Especially, you know, it's like a bucket list thing, and they see it, and these, you know, heavily tattooed snake guys are crying out of happiness. It's really moving, and so there are rewarding parts to what I do, but to be honest, most of it is really, you know, challenging, and you've got to keep pushing and whatever else. So, you know, with the support of the international community, it certainly gives me power and energy to keep moving forward, you know.
Well, it's encouraging to hear.
Yeah, well, this is less, like a year and a half ago, me was even more negative. It was like I was kind of almost depressed about it, just this continual battle. But you know, we've seen some victories, and we're doing, you know, we're moving. We certainly appear to be moving in a very positive way, and I'm sure there'll be barriers thrown up in front of us, but then, you know, we'll just have to keep trying to find a good way to get around them. And like the salamanders, you know, we need to find a way to overcome these barriers that keep getting thrown up.
Absolutely. Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for taking all this time to come and talk to us about this. And again, it's been a goal of mine since I started this 4 years ago to be able to have this kind of conversation, and it's been really enlightening. And I just want to give you the opportunity to provide the listeners. I mean, I'm going to include links in the show notes like I always do, but if you want to just share any resources, whether they're online or anything that you think the listeners would be interested in if they wanted to kind of take a deeper dive into this.
Sure. I mean, there's a few things really. Well, I'll start with, you know, like our organization and my own personal kind of websites and links and stuff. So if you, for Sustainable Dice, so Dyson is spelled D-A-I-S-E-N. So sustainabledyson.org will take you to our homepage. And there's, you know, there's links and information about salamanders. Some of it needs updating, but, you know, we try to keep on top of it. You can also sign up to a newsletter there. You can also donate there, which would be very, very appreciated and welcome. If you'd like to actually come and see them in the wild, if you go to bushidojapan.com, you can find links to information about the salamander tours that I run. Instagram is Japanese Giant Salamanders. That should be pretty easy to find. And then Bushido Japan as well. A couple of other things that, to really get a great understanding of the overall picture of what's going on. There was a journalist called Mara Budgin who came and spent a lot of time here and spoke to us and various important people in the salamander world. And she wrote an article, well, for The Guardian and for the Japan Times, but a more in-depth one on LifeGate. So if you were to go onto Google and search for LifeGate, Japanese giant salamanders, I think I sent you the link as well, so you might be able to share that. That really goes deep into a lot of the topics that I've covered today, or I've tried to cover today. And you really can understand about the Japanese government approach, social issues, you know, the global kind of view on it and everything like that. So LifeGate, Japanese giant salamanders. I think it's something about concrete is in the title, but I'm sure you can find it easily. And just in terms of like the Yamabushi stuff and the Yanchabo thing,
Just to give you a kind of visual representation of what I'm doing and where I am and what perhaps what Yamabushi means, you can actually go onto YouTube and look for Bad Boy Monk. And the channel was called This World. And it's like about 10 minutes kind of video that some volunteers of mine came in and made. So that gives you kind of a visual representation of this area and, you know, and what we're doing and the issue for the salamanders. So, you know, I recommend giving that a watch. I don't get any payback for watching that. So that's not why. Yeah, I mean, apart from that, I'm doing other nature tours from this year in Japan. So you can find out about that in bushidojapan.com. Nature Trek, also a company that I work with for amphibian tours. But, you know, any questions as well, just send me a message via email or the website or Instagram or whatever, really. And I will try my best to answer. And, yeah.
Well, again, I want to thank Richard for coming on, and this was just such an enlightening conversation, and it was really cool being able to have my first guest on from Japan, and looking forward to having more guests on internationally. I have a few people lined up from the UK and continental Europe and a couple of surprises coming up. So, well, I hope you guys all enjoy this episode. I sure did. I learned a lot, and like I said, stay out, you know, stay tuned, ready for the new content coming up. And I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I'll catch up with you again next time.